This is Here and Now. 250 years ago today, in the South Pacific, Captain James Cook was about to leave the island of Tahiti in search of a lost continent known as Terra Australis. Cook had been sent to the region by the British Admiralty, first to observe the transit of Venus, and then to find the storied continent. This was the first of three voyages, all lasting for years, that Cook took. When all was said and done, he was dead on a beach in Hawaii, but he lives in memory as one of the great explorers in human history. We're going to dive deep into his life and legacy over the next 2 days with Cliff Thornton, a member of the Captain Cook Society, who knows more about Captain Cook than almost anybody. Cliff, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Jeremy.
So when you think of the explorers of the world, where does Captain Cook rank?
He's not far off the top in terms of what he achieved and how much he completed the map of the world, considering what was available to him in the late 18th century.
And tell us about the places that he discovered, and I say discovered in quotes because there were already native peoples living in all of the places that he hit. But tell us about some of the places that he discovered for the Europeans.
Some of the places had been previously visited, such as he went to Tahiti to take some astronomers to do the transit of Venus. That had previously been visited by another English captain. He also went to New Zealand, but that had been visited by Abel Tasman some 60 years previously. He did visit Hawaii, but some say the Spanish had been there before him. Mm-hmm. You lose track of them. There are so many of them. When he started out, that the Pacific Ocean was really a blank canvas. And by the time he'd finished, that there were islands here, there, and everywhere that he'd mapped and often drawn detailed charts for them.
And it took a long time in those days to get from the British Isles out to the South Pacific. There was no Panama Canal to go through.
There was no Panama Canal, and he was sailing in what was called a North Sea collier. It had been built not for the Navy, it had been built for the coal trade. It was a snub-nosed thing. You were lucky if you could get 8 knots out of it.
Hmm. And so how long did it take to get from the UK out to, let's say, New Zealand?
Well, let's take Tahiti on that first voyage. It would be about 6 months. Wow. Not in one go. They stopped en route at various places, but the sailing time was easily 6 months.
And when you say they stopped en route, and especially when they stopped in some of these islands like Tahiti, like Tonga, like other places in the South Pacific, they encountered people there. So how did they interact? How did Captain Cook and his men interact with the people on the islands?
Well, the first place he went to was Tahiti, and he was fortunate there because a Polynesian priest came to him and said, look, I'd really like to travel with you. I know all this area. I can tell you where the islands are. I can help you navigate there, and I can help translate. His name was Tupaia, and he was worth his weight in gold. I don't think Cook could have achieved what he did if it hadn't been for Tupaia. Whenever he got to a new island, he would lead Cook ashore. He would say, sit on the sand, take your shirt off. I'm just going to make a speech. And Tupaia made the speech to the local chief and established peaceful relations. And it went from there.
Mm-hmm. So he used Tupaia as his translator.
Yeah. And the funny thing was, when Cook went back to New Zealand on the second voyage, the people said, where's Tupaia? Unfortunately, he died when he caught a disease at Batavia on the way home.
Now, Captain Cook's team also brought to these islands food, animals, plants, and as the late Tony Horowitz points out in his book, in many cases, venereal disease as well.
Yes, Cook's ships were often a bit like a Noah's Ark. There were so many animals on them. Some of them they took along for, let's say, feeding the crew, but primarily they were presenting to the chiefs of the islands where they visited to say, look, have these animals and they will breed if you look after them right. And because they were the chiefs, no one else on the island would interfere with them. And whenever he stopped, he would try and find a little piece of ground that he could till and plant some seeds to see if European species would grow there. So that if he was coming back another year, who knows, there might be a crop waiting for him. Mm-hmm. Some of the animals, he had so many chickens, he let a few loose, let's say in Queen Charlotte Sound on New Zealand. And he hoped that they would breed in the bush. I'm not sure whether they survived, but certainly the goats that he released certainly exist today. In fact, the New Zealand government have said, I don't care they've been there 250 years. They're an alien species. We want them eradicated.
What impact did he have overall on wildlife in some of these places?
I don't think he directly would have had any impact on wildlife. I mean, the naturalists on board wanted samples, so they might have shot a few birds, caught a few fish. Some fish would have been caught to feed the crew. But I don't think he really had an impact on the wildlife. It was those who came after him. It was the settlers who wanted to take a few animals from home.
Mm-hmm.
You look at Hawaii, poor old Hawaii, suffering tremendously from the number of alien species there, one of which is the little sparrow from England. Somebody must have taken it out because they wanted a sparrow there. There's probably more sparrows on Hawaii than there are in England now. It's on decline Wow. over here. And then you've got somebody like Vancouver, who traveled with Cook on the third voyage. He went back to Hawaii in 1793 and presented the king with a couple of bulls and cows and said, let them breed and you'll have a good herd. And by 1830, there were hundreds of head. The problem was they'd been just left to roam about on the hillside of Mauna Loa, the volcano, and they decimated the wildlife, taking with them many of the species that are no longer there.
Well, and how did Captain Cook reflect on his role as an outsider or a colonizer? It seems like he was a little hesitant about the impact that the European perspective would have on some of these cultures.
I wouldn't call him a colonizer. He was a visitor, and he was a regular visitor at some of the places, like New Zealand. He was there for every one of his three voyages. Mm-hmm. And the benefit of that was that he could see how the people changed from his first visit in 1769, 1773, I think, and then 1777. And it wasn't a good change. Hmm. And if there was one impact that had on all of the people, it was they discovered that the British had iron. There's no natural source of iron in any of the Pacific Islands. It was almost a Stone Age existence. If you wanted to cut something, you used a sharpened stone or you used an edge of a shell. And so to actually say, look, here's this metal that you can sharpen, you can get a blade on. And so by this last visit, Cook actually recorded in his journal that the people had become more greedy for the metal. Hmm. They wanted it so much, they would prostitute their wives or their daughters just to get some metal off the sailors. Hmm. And they were thieving from each other, stuff that had never existed before. And so Cook saw that, and he was disappointed that what he thought he would bring as benefit to the islanders was actually leading to a deterioration. And the same when he took some iron hatchets out on the second voyage. He'd seen they had hatchets made of stone, so he took some iron hatchets out. Here you are, lads, he said. You can chop the trees down with these. When he went back on the third voyage, they were using those same hatchets for attacking each other. That's not what he wanted.
Well, the reason that we know all of this about him is because he kept these meticulous notes along his journey every single day, writing in his journal. What kind of thoughts did he write down about what he was thinking?
He wrote down the day-to-day events, and then whenever he had finished a visit to an island, to a people's, he would summarize at quite length the description of the peoples, how they dressed, what they spoke, a glossary of their words sometimes, and a description of the land, whether it was rocky, whether the soil was good, whether it would support crops. And then he wrote down about the demeanor of the people. And as he went around the Pacific, he met people in vastly different stages of what you would say civilization, for want of a better word. In Tahiti, you had a social hierarchy, but the people lived in pretty plain huts and a pretty simple lifestyle. When he got to New Zealand, there was a far more structured social positions.
Mm-hmm.
They lived in large houses with these highly decorated fascias to them, and so they were far more advanced compared to Tahiti. Then he came to Australia and found the Aborigines leading almost a nomadic existence, surviving under pieces of bark for shelter. And at first sight, here, let me read what he wrote, because it's hard to believe that he wrote this. This is about the Aborigines in Australia. The natives appear to be the most wretched people upon earth. But In reality, they are far more happier than we Europeans, being wholly unacquainted not only with the superfluous, but the necessary conveniences so much sought after in Europe. They are happy in not knowing the use of them. They live in tranquility, which is not disturbed by the inequality of condition. They set no value upon anything we gave them, and nor would they ever part with anything of their own. This was a 42-year-old sailor. He speaks like a sociologist.
Right. Well, he's certainly seen enough people at this point in his life to have that background.
There was a sort of empathy coming across in there as well. He comes across as very much a humanitarian, and it hurts me so much when a lot of the indigenous peoples today are throwing sticks and stones verbally at Cook.
We're speaking with Cliff Thornton, who is a member of the Captain Cook Society, about Captain Cook. Cliff Thornton, let me ask you this. Captain Cook, as he was sailing around the world on his three voyages, was doing this with no modern technology, no sonar, for example, no GPS. Yeah. But the fact that he had no sonar actually led him to almost sinking his ship after he ran aground on the Great Barrier Reef.
Yes, yes. I think he was aware that as he was sailing north along the coast of the east coast of Australia, he was aware that there were reefs there. And sometimes they would anchor overnight, so there was no risk of running into them. But if there was too much depth to anchor, he went on at a slow speed. And it was in the middle of one night where he actually bumped into an isolated reef near Cooktown off Queensland.
Cooktown, named after him.
Yeah, wasn't there then, of course.
Then, right, yeah.
It was quite a bad leak, and the water was coming in, so he had to lighten the boat as quickly as he could. And the heaviest things on board were the cannon. And there were four cannon on the deck. He threw them overboard. He had a couple of cannon down below. He threw those overboard. He even took the iron ballast out and threw it overboard. And, you know, all those things were recovered 200 years later.
Wow.
They're scattered around the world. One's gone to the Philadelphia Museum. There's one in Sydney. There's one in the National Maritime Museum here in Greenwich.
Now, you mentioned Cooktown. He actually didn't name that many places after himself that he found, right?
Didn't name many. He didn't name any. Whenever possible, he would name a place using the name that he thought the locals gave it. Sometimes there were differences in spellings and pronunciations, but that was what he did. If it was a major feature, a mountain or something important like that, he would name it after a senior member of the government in the UK or a member of the gentry. Mm-hmm. And the bigger the geographical feature, the more important the person he would name it after.
What did he achieve from a navigation and mapping perspective? Because I understand that New Zealand was relying on Captain Cook's mapping of the islands until not that long ago.
You're right. 200 years. It's absolutely incredible that he could produce such a detailed map with what was called the running survey, which is sailing along, taking your bearings, using your angles, using your sextants and the plane table that he had on board, and producing that map. And that map existed until we sent satellites up and we could get an accurate picture of New Zealand from space.
Now, he wasn't just looking in the South Pacific. He also went up to the Northwest Passage between modern-day Alaska and Russia. What was he trying to do there?
The aim was to improve trade with the Far East. And the only way of getting to the Far East in those days was to go either by the Cape of Good Hope around South Africa or via Cape Horn at the bottom of South America. He took an enormous length of time to get to the Far East and to trade with China and India. The suggestion was that there may be a route to go over the north of Canada and come down through the Bering Strait, and that's what Cook was trying to do.
And he was not successful in doing that.
He got through the Bering Strait, but as he had encountered on his second voyage when he was in the Antarctic, you can only go so far before you hit a wall of ice, and you couldn't progress any further.
And you're dealing with a wooden ship, right? Not an icebreaker.
That's correct.
So Cook's legacy today is complicated. How do people regard the places that he discovered for the British, the monuments to him? Some of them have been vandalized over the years.
Well, if you ask me what his legacy is, it would be a different story to if you asked an indigenous, let's say Maori or somebody from Hawaii. But as you are asking me, then I think that his legacy is the map of the Pacific. I remember there was a French explorer who was going to go out, and somebody said, well, what are you going to do? And he said, I don't know. Cook's done it all. There's nothing left for me to find, I don't think. A common thing that's in England today is tattooing has become very, very popular. It was Cook's voyages that brought tattooing back to the UK. Mm-hmm. They were, the sailors were tattooed out in Tahiti and places around there and brought them back and said, hey, look what I've got. And now look what's happened. It's everywhere.
Well, tattooing, and the other word that sounds like tattoo also came from Cook's voyages, which is taboo.
Taboo, yeah. Which the priest or the king could put on an area and nobody would break that taboo. His legacy was also involved in curing scurvy. Have you heard of scurvy?
Yeah, well, scurvy, I didn't know much about scurvy before I learned about this, but basically it was the lack of vitamin C, and these sailors on these ships would go out there, and obviously you can't take oranges and lemons and limes for that many months at sea, so they wouldn't have anything.
Well, they didn't know what the cure was or what the cause was. They just knew that after 3 weeks after leaving shore, if you didn't have any fresh greens, etc., you would start to show these terrible signs of scurvy. And it is often pointed out that the great battles that were fought with the Royal Navy, more men died of scurvy than died during the battles. Hmm. It's that bad. Ships sailing, let's say the Dutch East India Company sailing around to the East Indies, would way overcrew their ships simply because they knew a third of the men would die on the way with scurvy. So Cook's voyage on Endeavour, his first expedition, it was filled with all manner of suggested treatments to cure the scurvy. And he came back after 3 years. 3 years at sea, he hadn't lost a man to scurvy. He'd lost them to various diseases that they contracted at Batavia. He'd lost one of the Marines overboard when he got drunk and jumped. But he hadn't lost a man to scurvy. And the Royal Society gave him a medal for that. The truth was, I don't think he knew what had actually stopped it. He had so many different remedies on board, one of the most famous being sauerkraut, pickled cabbage.
Mm-hmm.
The men weren't too keen on sauerkraut. So Cook told the ship's cook, dress some sauerkraut for me and put it on the officer's table every day and say, this is for officers only. And it was a little bit of psychology, and it worked, because the men said, hey, we want that. And they ate it, and maybe that kept the scurvy away.
Let's talk about how Captain Cook died. He died in Hawaii. He was killed in Hawaii. What happened?
Well, it's a long, sad story. He'd had a successful visit to Hawaii, and he set off to continue north to the Bering Strait again, but the ship sprung a mast, and he had to return. He came back to Kealakekua Bay, which was where he'd been before. It's said that he'd come back at a different series when a different god was in favour. Okay, he could live with that. But he didn't like them stealing one of the ship's cutters. So he invited a local chief to come on board, and the chief was walking along the coast to get on his boat. And the people said, don't go, chief, don't go. And the chief sat down. And people came from the other side of the bay and said, look, bad things are happening. Don't go with this man. They formed up along the beach, and suddenly a hail of stones came over from the people, and Cook fired one of the barrels. He had a double-barrel blunderbuss type thing. Mm-hmm. It had small shot in. It didn't have anything. The small shot bounced off the cape. This man thought, hey, he's shot, and I'm not being killed. And it just emboldened them, and I'm afraid they attacked the shore party. The Marines fired, but you know how long it takes to reload one of those long muskets. They were all over them, and they just ran for their lives to the boats. And, of course, Cook, he was left on the beach, and he was attacked, and he was drowned there. Yeah.
So the reason that we are talking about this right now is because the author Tony Horowitz just recently passed away suddenly, and he had written this incredible book with your help about Captain Cook. You're one of the subjects in the book.
Oh, I just have a walk on roll.
Walk on roll. Well, you're in there for at least 100 pages. But anyway, he went and retraced the steps of Captain Cook.
Yes, he certainly did.
Well, let's just talk about Tony Horowitz for a minute. What was it like to work with him?
It was an honor and a privilege, and I didn't realize it at the time. But that man was I would call him a literary alchemist. He took what I thought were ordinary events of the day, things that were made of lead. But when you read about them in his book, he turned them into burnished gold. I'm thinking, well, I was there, I saw that, but I never saw it through the eyes that Tony had, to make it so readable. I once had the privilege of having a peek in his study, and the bookcase was absolutely full of the best, the most academic books about Cook. That man's had such a knowledge about Cook.
Well, and I would recommend that any of our listeners go and read this book, Blue Latitudes, Boldly Going Where Captain Cook Has Gone Before, because it is really fascinating. Cliff Thornton, let me just ask you finally, what made you so interested in Captain Cook in the first place?
Well, I was born and bred in a little place called Stockton-on-Tees, which is a couple of miles from the little village of Marton where Cook was born. And I guess as a teenager, I didn't really appreciate him. And it was not till I returned to Middlesbrough following my career in museums that I just happened to be there when the town was celebrating the 250th anniversary of Cook's birth. The town took the bold decision to build a brand new museum about Captain Cook. And Cook's been with me ever since.
That is Cliff Thornton, who is a member of the Captain Cook Society. Thank you so much for joining us and remembering Captain Cook.
A real pleasure, Jeremy. Thank you.